All right, so even though I moved to Canada just 2 or 3 months ago, I collected a bunch of affiliations already, and it's pretty impressive how fast you can accumulate them. Before I begin, let me start with gathering some statistics about you guys. So who has here background in quantum foundations and quantum correlations? Okay. What about convex programming? Okay. A few. Quantum many-body physics. Odd. Okay. Interesting that you guys form clusters. So the quantum many-body physicists are here and quantum foundations people are there. Deep learning. Shallow learning. Okay. Very good. Very good. So what I want to talk about today is a result of me getting angry. Like that's my typical way of doing research. So I normally see some papers appearing in archive, which upset me, and I'm like, I can do it better. And but you have to know that I still didn't prove that I can do better in what I wanted to talk about. So the papers that upset me came out about 1.5 years ago, a bit less. And since then it became a trend. And it's very alarming, and it's about using machine learning in quantum info and quantum foundations. And I think if we continue in this direction, that's gonna be bad because it will discredit the use of machine learning in quantum foundations. So you have to be very, very careful on how to use these techniques. And basically, this is what I'm going to talk about. What are the things to avoid, and what are the things that make a bit more sense? And I really like this aphorism. You know, the question of whether machines can think is about as relevant as the question of whether submarines can swim. So the reason I have this here is because I'm not so concerned about explaining what an AI model can do and how it comes up with some kind of a prediction or model. I'm interested in how it can augment our understanding of physics, maybe give a new insight or a new intuition, which then we would verify one way or the other. So that's the direction I want to go in. And so the related issues are roughly this. So it's machine learning is really good at doing things on scale. Like that's it, it's all about today. That you have all these computational resources, you throw it at a problem, and it gives you some kind of predictions. But it seldom gives you any kind of certificate whether the prediction is correct. So it tells you know, whether an image is a cat or a dog, or whether a state is entangled or not, but it doesn't tell you why, but as I saw showed in this aphorism, it's maybe not so relevant. But it's more important that you know it's unclear how you would certify this answer. Then when you talk about convex relaxations and convex programming in the use of quantum foundations, they give you certificates. But they don't scale very well with the system size. And so this is something, an area I worked a lot for the past 4 years, coming up with scalable convex programming solutions for certifying things in quantum correlations. And out of this came a strange and unexpected result, which was about quantum optimization. So the way quantum optimization works today, it also gives you some kind of an output, some kind of an optimum, but no guarantees. Whether it's the actual optimum or not. So the talk will be about these three issues and how they relate to each other in interesting ways. And again, like what are the things that we should avoid. And so we already have a few papers on this. I think these are the most relevant. So in this paper, which came out in PRX last year, we showed how we can scale up these convex programming certificates to very large multipartite systems. The largest we tested was 29, but it's simply because our computer just wasn't big enough. And then we had this paper coming out just 2 months ago. It was about studying phase transitions in many-body localization and saying something about that. And it's very interesting how it fits into this larger picture of how you certify results that come out from machine learning. And this is the latest one. So it came out yesterday, and basically I was blackmailing my co-authors that, hey, I'm giving a talk in the Parameter, we have to finish this paper. So this paper has been in the making for 6 years and it's finally out. So if you want to look up more details, then just look at these papers. So the overall objective is this, you know, if we want to use machine learning for gaining some intuition on some question in quantum foundations or quantum embedded physics, we want to obtain certificates, and then we have to go through some iterative process to gain new intuition, new certificates, until you find new physics. And I'm not interested in interpretability and explainability. A few papers on that. I find it very unlikely that some machine learning model will find you, say, new physical laws. I think the human has to be in the loop to come up with that sort of stuff. Yeah. Oh yeah, please ask questions.
What do you mean by certificate and what do you mean by verification?
Okay, so...
what are you certifying and what are you verifying?
Okay, so it's my terminology is a little bit confusing. So I'm using verification and certification in the same sense. And what is it about is, for instance, you can certify whether correlations violate the Bell inequality or not, right? So a Bell inequality would be a kind of a not very good entanglement certificate. Does it make sense? Mm-hmm. So I'm using these two terms interchangeably.
Can you go back to 2 slides ago where you had your 3 things? Back one more, So quantum optimization, you can tell that you get a solution that's better than what you knew, but the certification here would be that it's the global minimum. Is that?
It's a certification, yes. So what you can tell is with the scheme that I'm going to tell you is a lower bound on the ground state, whereas also, you know, the variation lenses always give you some upper bound, and I can give you a lower bound. And if this coincides with your actual solution that you pull out from some quantum optimizer, then you can be absolutely sure that you are in the global optimum.
So that's what this result is about, is a lower bound.
Yeah.
And what are the resource requirements for that?
I'm going to talk about it. I'm going to show you the scaling and all of that. You can certify like 2,000 qubits and it goes pretty well. Okay. So, you know, if machine learning was intelligent, then we would have a very easy task. So imagine that this set is your original data, okay? It lies in some high dimension space, and it clusters into 3 different classes. If these were just 2 classes, and that these could be some entanglement and separable states in some very high dimension space, in many party setup. And then you can use an algorithm to identify these clusters. For instance, you can use this T stochastic neighborhood embedding, which does 2 things. One, it separates, it embeds things into a lower dimensional space, a 2D or 3D space, and then it tries to identify this clustering structure in the high dimensional space. And on a good day, it identifies the actual clusters, right? But bear in mind that here we know the colors a priori. So it's not that it's the algorithm puts the colors. No. We put the colors. So we look at the extracted structures, and then we can label them that, you know, these are the different things that we are looking at. And if it worked like, you know, on every data set perfectly, and it would always find a structure, that would be great, you know, because then we could use it for classifying all sorts of stuff in quantum info. But on a bad day, running the same algorithm with just different parameters ends up with no clustering structure whatsoever, right? So I just changed one parameter and everything is mixed up. So this is why it is dangerous to make claims that, you know, just by using T, S, and E, I can separate separable and entangled states. This is something we tried. So if you are looking at a pair of qubits or a pair of qutrits, you can just use the Peres-Horodetsky criterion for telling, you know, whether a state is entangled and separable. So it's a very easy task. And if you use this algorithm, TSNE, you see that it nicely clusters the structures into there is some margin between the two sets. So you could actually split these into entangled and contangled and separable states. But then, you know, imagine that you have a new state coming in and the state gets some position, say, in between. Then you have absolutely no idea, you know, whether that should be separable or an entangled state. And again, you're probably seeing this clear separation because the problem is easy to begin with. So the moment it gets, the moment you can't apply the Peres Horowitz criterion, you have some, say, 2-4-dimensional systems, and it suddenly breaks down. And we knew this. So I was in a quantum info group for 3 years, but I'm a machine learning guy. So, and I never found like a good application area in quantum info for machine learning all these years. So when I was doing stuff that was related to quantum info, I was doing convex relaxations. And when I was doing machine learning, I was focusing on like quantum machine learning. And I never saw any overlap. And then came out a few papers and I got really upset. So this was the first one that got me upset. So it created a very simple, shallow machine learning model, a decision tree, to come up with separating entanglement and separable states. But again, whatever this decision tree output was uncertifiable. So why would you trust the decision of this machine learning model? Like, it doesn't advance your understanding of anything. And then came out another one, which was taking Bell inequalities, applying nonlinear transformations on them, and call it machine learning. But again, there was no new insight to anything foundational. So this is what got me started. Like, what is it that would make sense? That would be machine learning applied in the quantum foundations research. And so basically the key takeaway for me today, that if you continue working in this direction and you follow the pattern set before, these two papers, or just by using TSN for whatever problem you have, you fall into a trap. And this is going to discredit machine learning and AI in research in quantum physics. You have to be really, really careful. So I really think that certification is what is absolutely necessary when you apply machine learning in any kind of physics problem. You have to be sure that what you are doing makes sense. But then, the first thing that you should start addressing is that the problem that you are trying to solve is certifiable to begin with, right? So this is the reason why we moved away, for instance, looking at entanglement and separable states into looking at correlations, making local measurements and coming up with Bell inequalities, new families of Bell inequalities on different multipartite systems, because the quantum correlations are just easier to classify into local and non-local correlations than like just arbitrary separable and entanglement states. So this is a good problem it's a better problem to attack by machine learning, because whatever your system outputs eventually will be certifiable one way or the other. And so I want to talk a little bit about how this certification scheme works, because it turns out to be quite universal. So the idea goes back to 2001, so a good 17 years ago. So it goes back to this problem of finding the global minimum of a polynomial of real variables. And your constraints, this describes some kind of a set. It doesn't have to be convex. So this set is also described by another set of polynomials. These are inequalities and equalities. So this is a general polynomial optimization problem. And it has a generalization to the non-commuting case. So in this case, you have a Hermitian polynomial of non-commuting operators. And you describe your set of constraints by various constraints that are imposed on polynomials of your operators. So everything is the same as in the commuting case, except that now you have to use trace operators and a couple of things have to be Hermitian, otherwise it's all the same. And so this is, before we move on, the one big difference is that when you measure expectation values on polynomials of just real numbers, then these expectation values can be really in any kind of measure. You don't have restrictions on the measure. Now, when you talk about a measure in this space, which happens to also be These are actually quantum states here that are embedded in these expectation values. It turns out that you don't have this freedom. So the only meaningful measure that you can use over non-commuting operators has this structure, so that the trace of the operator in some state. That's very curious. So basically, when you think about different expectation values or different measures in these non-commuting operator problems, what you're thinking about is just different quantum states, because that will define your measure. Okay, so what you're doing in either case, whether it's commuting or non-commuting, is a semi-definite programming relaxation, which means that what you're doing is you take a monomial of your operators, or any monomial of real values, and you replace that by a single variable. So you linearize the problem. And that's what goes into this objective function. So this yw is just a variable replacing a previous monomial. And then new constraints enter the problem. So you end up with something called moment matrices, which are just collections of different moments, different expectation values of these monomials. And you generate various additional matrices and positive semi-definite constraints for your original constraints. And this is now a convex problem to solve. And a convex problem will have some well-defined global optimum that's relatively straightforward to find. So this is the idea of this NPA hierarchy, and it works very well in certified quantum correlations and also in a bunch of other problems, like verifying the results of a quantum computation and so on. The big problem with this is that the original problem was NP hard. Finding the global optimum of a polynomial optimization problem is NP hard. And now then this is technically a polynomial time algorithm. So what you're training off is that this is going to be some relaxation and approximation, and it only recovers the correct global optimum of the original problem if you keep making these semi-definite programs bigger and bigger. And it turns out that even for a two-party Bell scenario, in some edge cases, it grows so much that you run out of computational power to get the actual correct result. So scalability is a big issue. And so this is what a lot of my work was focused on for the last 3-4 years.
I think it's a question here.
Yeah.
Is it known a priori that for a given finite, so I don't go to set infinity more and more,
yeah,
the solution is an upper bound or a lower bound on that minima you have?
It is always a lower bound. It's an increasing lower bound. It's a strictly...
Oh, okay. Interesting.
Yeah. No, it's not strictly, but it's a monotonically increasing lower bound. This is why it is critically important in verifying, for instance, quantum calculations. I'll get there in a moment.
I'm missing some big picture issue here. So you're converting this into a semi-definite program.
That's right.
Which is might not be a tight lower bound because of this finite dimension.
Yeah.
And it's a polynomial problem. But is it a polynomial problem on a classical processor?
This is all classical for the time being.
Right.
So, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And it takes as input the candidate solution or just the problem?
No, it's
going to spit out a solution, right? So that doesn't fit into this yet.
Okay. I get that. It's four or five slides more.
Sorry, I'm very impatient. Yeah. I apologize. Yeah, yeah.
It was a byproduct of this result, actually. So this result was about certifying quantum correlations coming from large multi-party systems. So in this case, what we took 29 parties. That was the largest that we could solve. And we could still certify whether a correlation was local or non-local. And the way we did it is, goes back to Bell inequality. So you can think about a Bell inequality as a polynomial optimization problem. And basically, that's what you are trying to optimize over. And when you think about this big multipartite system, you can have correlations, single body correlations, two body correlations, and then full body correlation between all n parties. And that's where it gets really nasty, because then if you look at this as a polynomial, as a monomial, and it has n elements. And that would require a very, very big semi-definite program just to be able to include this in a moment matrix. So this is where scalability would absolutely break down for an n-body system. And so realize that it's enough if you consider the two-body correlators and you still get valid certificates and you can still verify a very large family of quantum correlations, whether they are quantum or not. And this observation led us to that, maybe we could use it elsewhere. So then we would look at the Ising model. And you know, the Ising model is also nothing but a polynomial optimization problem. It's just a quadratic optimization problem. And when you look at what quantum optimizers solve, they essentially solve this problem. Whether you're looking at the DVF quantum annealer or whether you are looking at quantum approximator optimization, it all solves the Ising model. So it started at that. And you know, when you think about the Ising model, it has many uses. For instance, it is apart from being interesting on its own, right? It can also use it for denoising images. So I had a master's student who was using the Ising model to denoise images of Pikachu. And he was burning like thousands of dollars worth of computing time on DVF. And then you can move forward with this idea because in just the classicalizing model, everything is commuting, so it's an easy problem. But then you can think of some quantumizing model when you also have, say, sigma x interaction. And then it becomes a non-commuting problem, and that's even harder to solve. Yep?
What do you mean by solving the Ising model?
Solving the Ising model is finding the ground state of the Ising model.
And how's this quadratic?
Beg your pardon?
Solving for their ground state is a linear problem.
It's not. It's quadratic. You have a quadratic interaction.
So you're changing the terms in the Hamiltonian, and then you want to find the ground state?
I'm not changing the terms of the Hamiltonian.
You just keep solving the problem. I just don't know what you mean. What are you optimizing?
Solving the problem means that I minimize the expectation value of this Hamiltonian. So if you look at the formal...
What are the variables, I guess?
Yeah, that's a very good question. So let's go back here. This was the generic form of the non-commuting case. So P of x will be my Hamiltonian given in my Pauli operators. So what I'm optimizing over is rho. So when you look at it, then it becomes...
So the terms in your Hamiltonian are variable or fixed?
So the terms in my Hamiltonian, these are fixed operators. It's the expectation value that I'm trying to minimize.
I think the instance of the problem is a set of parameters of the Hamiltonian, and then you're trying to find the state that is the ground state of that.
But you're allowed to change the terms in the Hamiltonian as well?
Well, that's the way the integer works, but that's not the problem.
That's not the problem we are solving. The problem is minimizing this expectation value by optimizing over all of these states.
Okay.
Okay?
Sure.
So that's what I solve. That's what I mean by solving it. Yeah.
Okay.
Because from like an optimization perspective, this is what we'd call a solution. Okay. Same thing here for various flavors of the Hubbard model. So here I have a Fermi-Hubbard model, but you can also think of it as the Bose-Hubbard model. It doesn't matter which Hubbard model that you take. But now the problem with these is that the semi-definite program grows so fast that if you take, for instance, the Fermi-Hubbard model, then even for a 3x3 lattice, you would need a supercomputer to solve. So it doesn't scale particularly well. So this got us thinking, this is not good. This is pretty useless. So I wasted like 2 years on this, just trying to scale it up. Until we figured that the same intuition that we found in this many-party or multi-party Bell scenario could be applied here. Because what actually matters is neighboring interactions. So you don't necessarily have to factor in the full n-body correlators when it comes to finding the ground state of these Hamiltonians. And then it turns out that there is a way to split up your original semi-definite program into smaller chunks that disregards these long-range correlations. And as long as you fulfill a very simple mathematical condition, which means that this dependency graph between your lattice sites or between your variables is chordal, which means that between any three nodes there is a K3, like a triangle, then it will eventually converge again to the same solution. It's a relaxation of a relaxation, but it scales much better. Because what you're going to have is, for instance, let's take a classicalizing model with just three sites on a chain. And this will be your original problem when you create the moment matrix. So you see that there are moments between sites that are not neighboring, and also three-body correlators. And these are the ones that blow up in size when you start to consider all possible correlations between different sites. But if you use this chordal extension, what you can do is you can split these moment matrix blocks into the much nicer, smaller chunks. So now you want to consider interactions between sigma 1 and sigma 2, and sigma 2 and sigma 3, and you disregard everything else. And if you do this and apply one more trick, which is called branch and bound, then you get very nice scalability, very nice scalable certificates for a wide range of problems. So what branch and bound is it means that we observe that when we obtain a solution, then this solution is a bunch of expectation values, right? So you cannot necessarily extract the quantum state for it. In fact, in general, you cannot extract it. But some expectation values in single sigma operators, for instance, can tell you whether it's plus 1 or minus 1, closer to plus 1 or minus 1. So you can fix that value in plus 1 and minus 1 and solve the same thing again for these two subproblems. Whichever is smaller, you just take that and we continue this heuristic until results converge. And the results converge fairly fast, in this case, under 20 iterations. And now this is very interesting because this gives you a much, much, much tighter bound on what you're trying to estimate. And by exploiting this chordal extension, that also makes this huge difference. So if you use the branch and bound without the chordal extension, then the time to solution just blows up very fast. Whereas if we start exploiting the sparsity of the problem, then you get a very nice scalable solution that scales to fairly large system sizes. Like here we cut it off at 15, but eventually we can do much, much, much bigger systems. It's a 2D Ising model, so it's 15 times 50 lattice. do we have sparsity? We have seen that for quantum correlations, we definitely do. This gave the motivation to start using it in many-body systems. Then when you look at actual quantum hardware, they almost always have sparse connectivity structures. So in this case, this is the 19-qubit chip by Rigetti, which is so noisy that you can't use it for much, and actually it's no longer working, because their refrigerators failed and their qubits died in the process. But even when it existed, it had this sparse connectivity structure, and you could use quantum approximate optimization, which again just finds or approximates the ground state of an Ising model, and that's very easily certified by our method. And when you look at what the D-wave connectivity structure is, so this was the 2048-qubit chip. It also has a very sparse connectivity. So we can actually certify solutions coming out of this annealer by this method. It scales up to this extent. So these are actual numerical results comparing what we got. And you see that very often the solution pulled out from the device coincides with what we get. So that means that you actually stayed in the ground state during the adiabatic change. Right? It's not an adiabatic change, but during quantum annealing. And but other times you are a bit above what we predict by a lower bound. And by the way, these are not just lower bounds because these are the actual ground state because our branch and bound method converged, which means that you actually get both the lower and an upper bound. and they coincide. And what we're interested in that, you know, when we get a case when the two numbers don't match, then what is the configuration of the spins in the two different lattices? So we wanted to see, you know, whether DWave is actually close to that configuration or it's stuck in some distant local optimum. And what so what we see is that it seems to be fairly far from the actual solution. I don't know whether there's anything deep to that, because it might be just some degenerate solution with multiple optimal spin configurations. I don't know, but it was interesting to see that they don't necessarily coincide at all. Okay, so just a few words on machine learning. So this is the third machine learning talk today, so I don't want to waste too much time on it. An easy problem in machine learning is when you try to tell one thing from the other, when you try to discriminate what's one thing and what's the other thing. This is where the state of the art of machine learning excels at. And so one example is, you know, classifying selfies, good selfies from bad selfies. This is a problem that's extremely easy from all possible angles, because it's very easy to get data. You can just pull off a bunch of images from Twitter and count how many times the particular image was retweeted. That will be your measure of quality. And so data is cheaply available. You can just throw a convolutional neural network on it, and it can very easily split a good selfie from a bad selfie according to your figure of merit. And what's really hard to do, though, but that's the direction that we should be going as research scientists in quantum foundations or quantum modifier physics, is related to generative models. So in generative models, instead of a conditional distribution that, hey, if I see X, I should output the label Y, what we are trying to approximate is that a full joint probability distribution of X and Y. This is a much harder problem to solve. And I don't know if you guys can see it well, but this is state of the art, well, state of the art 2 years ago. It was a particular architecture called generative adversarial networks, trained on generating dogs. And you know, some dogs have three legs, others have five, and you know, too many eyeballs. So they are not very, very good in generating these dogs. They are really creepy dogs. And so since then, this area advanced. So by now they can generate 1,000 by 1,000 images. And you can also make them conditional. So for instance, if you want to generate images of chihuahuas, you can tell the network that, you know, I want chihuahuas. But it's still a very, very hard problem. But this is, I think, a lot more relevant to us. And you will see in a moment why. But I want to talk a little bit about, like, why deep architectures in the first place. So this is what the people used to do in computer vision in the 1990s. So they had these convolutional filters, which, for instance, they were smoothing out an image, or this convolutional filter would identify the edges in the image. So this small filter would slide over the entire image and produce this new image after applying the convolution. And these were handcrafted for, I don't know, 3 decades of computer vision. And what deep learning really changed is that it made these filters trainable, and you have subsequent layers of these filters. And what you end up is these automatically extracted filters. Like, some go for shapes, others go for different color patterns. And as you keep applying more and more in a sequence, you arrive at a higher and higher level of abstraction, the problem domain that you are trying to learn on. And then this is what you attach your discriminative learner on, or this is what you try to use for generating new stuff. But that's the key insight. It's abstraction, what is automatically extracted. And then we can start thinking about it. Hey, so what is there that, you know, we can do with quantum resources? So my research area today really is quantum machine learning. And I think the interesting problems to address by using quantum resources are the ones which are difficult to use by difficult to solve by classical machine learning. So problems that are difficult to solve by deep learning, for instance. And you know, generative models are particularly hard to solve by these deep learning networks. And this is exactly where you have a good fit for instance, for Bolzan machines or reduced Bolzan machines, which are quintessentially generative, so they can you know, give you elements of some probability distribution. And if you keep stacking them and you start looking at what they actually do, they create the same kind of abstract representation as your traditional classical deep learning networks. So they seem to have this, you know, like the advantages of two worlds. On one hand, they are generative. On the other hand, they still create the kind of abstractions that enable you to express very complicated problems. So then, you know, let's take a look at how we put these things together and how it ends up, how we can turn it into something meaningful and useful. So we've been working with Patrick here on this problem for a good year and a half of using deep learning for identifying phase transitions, but identifying phase transitions in a non-trivial way. And by that, I mean the following. You know, a trivial way of doing it is that, you know, just like in the case of selfies, where you have labels, which would be the number of retweets, then in the phase transition problem, the identical approach would be to have states from two different phases of the meta. And then you would start to recognize the two phases of the meta. Same thing with entangled or separable states. As long as you have the labels, then you can generate your neural network and get some prediction for a state that you don't know. But this is not so interesting in phase transitions, because what you're actually interested in is where the phase transition is when you don't know where it is a priori. And then you cannot use this approach that you have labeled examples, because you don't have the luxury of labeled examples, particularly in the critical region close to the phase transition. So what we are thinking that, okay, then let's do this. Let's take some trivial examples, stuff that's deep in the phase, okay? So because for those two cases, we can be sure that, you know, one is in phase one, another is in phase two. And like ignore what's on the actual boundary. And we feed those states into a you know, regular classifier, which is the exact same pipeline as for classifying selfies. But let's also feed in all states from this phase space. So we randomly sample the phase space, including stuff from the boundary, and we feed it into a second network. And the second network's task is different, because here you know you don't necessarily have the label for the state, because you know for here in the boundary we don't have the label to begin with. So the purpose of this second classifier that we attach to the abstract representation is to tell where the state is coming from, whether it's a labeled instance or whether it's coming from all over the state space. And it tries to destroy the representation that this first network is working on. So it tries to make the work of this network really, really difficult. So it's sort of, so this is just plain gradient descent. This is gradient descent with an opposite sign. So the reason you do that is because it becomes the hardest task to solve for this classifier. So by that, you achieve that the representation that you have here after the convolutional layer is robust, invariant across the entire phase space. And then you can use that high-level description for identifying phase transitions. And then you end up with some really nice results. First of all, you need like 100 times realizations to identify many-body localization phase transition, and you get reasonable error bars, and you can identify the point of the phase transition. But then, you know, let's go back to this distinction between discriminative and generative learning, right? So this is still a discriminative learning. In a sense, it's a natural fit for classical deep learning architectures. So what's really missing here? Okay, so we can certify our results by comparing it with other people's older results that they got by numerical methods. But that's pretty much our certificate, right? So there's nothing telling us that if we use this neural network into some physical system that we absolutely don't know anything about, then we can be sure that the phase transition is there. There is no certificate. And so I think the insight here is that if you use a discriminative machine learning model, then you probably don't get some certifiable result. Because if it was certifiable in itself, then you would probably start using those certificates instead of the machine learning method. This is exactly what we do in studying quantum correlations, right? So you can come up with a decision tree that beautifully tells like which correlations are local and which are non-local, but you still stick with your SDPs because you can be absolutely sure that your SDP will correctly tell you what's a non-local correlation and what's a local correlation. And no matter how much I was thinking about it, I cannot come up with any discriminative learning problem in quantum info, quantum body physics, which is certifiable one way or the other. So here's a more interesting one. So this is the work in progress. And this is, I think, why we should look at generative models in getting new insight in quantum physics. Now imagine that you have some experimental setup for generating quantum states and, you know, your measurements have imperfections. And you want to find out like what are the best measurements that you can apply on the set of states that you can prepare with your apparatus to get Bell violations. And it's unclear how you would do it. This is a very difficult optimization problem. So now what you can start doing is that you can start training, say, a Bolzan machine with quantum states and measurements going into it and some corresponding violations, okay? And then what you can ask, or not sense the violations, but say some value of some Bell inequality. And then what you can keep doing once you train your Bolzan machine is that you can feed in, say, a target violation that you want. Say, you know, if you have this violation, then you know that, you know, it's not an experimental error if you actually implement it in the lab. And then you can start pulling out like corresponding states and corresponding measurements by sampling the model, because it's generative, it learns the joint probability distribution. And whatever you get here is now easily certified, because you can just verify it for the Bell inequality or some SDP. So I think this is the way to go. Generate new measurements, new states, or other parameters of some problem that you have at hand. Because as long as whatever is generated can be certified, that's a meaningful problem to solve by machine learning. Does it make sense? Okay. And then you can, you know, start thinking about it. Now we can plug in a quantum computer. Because since generative models are a very natural fit to train these models with quantum resources, you can actually get tangible benefits. So what I'm measuring here is the KL divergence between a target distribution that I'm trying to learn and my approximate distribution that the Bolzan machine represents. And ignore the blue line here. I always forget what the blue line is. But the point is that the green curve is what the classically trained Bolzan machine is. So it gives you some quality of the KL divergence, lower numbers are obviously better, then it tapers off. But if you pull out samples from a quantum annealer and you use that for training the Bolzan machine, then you get a measurable difference in the quality of your approximation to the distribution. And this is terrific. So now you can start using quantum resources for machine learning that would give you some new insight in quantum physics. That's the way to go, I think. And if you are interested in pursuing this, well, the good news is that everything that we do with the people I collaborate with is open source. So here are a bunch of repositories that you can take a look at. So the first one would give you these SDP relaxations for a wide variety of problems. Then this is the chordal branch and bound, which is this like super scalable solution for many body systems, whether that's about correlations or about Ising models. Then Alex Posas has this collection of machine learning models, including a bunch of bots and machines that we are training for generating new Bell experiments. And then Patrick has this library on studying phase transitions. So that's really all I wanted to tell. So I uploaded the slides here if you want to download them. What I'm saying is be careful. So just because you use machine learning, that doesn't mean that the result is meaningful. It's usually not. So think in terms of certification. Start with thinking about certification first and then apply machine learning. Thank you very much. More questions? Yep.
In terms of certification, your ideal case would be where I train the network somewhere in some domain that I understand how things are, then have another domain which I cannot calculate everything, but on the fly I can give you some sort of certificate.
For instance, yeah.
So like doing some sampling and on that, I can always sample a distribution, for instance, in some space. I can never have a distribution, but for distribution I can get you some block probability. And then I can compare it to what you're watching.
If you accept the probabilistic certificate, then it works. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I think in quantum many-body physics, we're a bit more flexible with this.
Yeah.
But in quantum info, like in analyzing quantum correlations, like you don't want a certificate that tells you, hey, you know, I'm 90% sure that this state is entangled. Right? It really depends on what you're doing. Ali?
So I guess two questions. You talked about the chordal situation where when the relationship between variables is chordal, that it's significantly easier. Why is that?
It's not easier, it's a lot more scalable. Because you can factorize your giant moment matrix into much smaller blocks. And eventually, the largest SDP that you can solve will decide on the size of this block, because that defines your memory use. And basically, you are constrained by how much RAM you have in a single node in a supercomputer. And that's why you want to factorize these blocks to be as small as possible.
And why does it allow you to use this memory? I'm just missing something here.
Okay, so let me use the blackboard. So imagine that you have your moment matrix, and we have some level two relaxation, and we have all sorts of long range correlations considered. Okay, so we have a correlation between sigma one and sigma n somewhere here. Okay, and what I'm saying is that it's enough to restrict to nearest neighbor interactions, and you still get meaningful results. And so since you consider n-body interaction here at level two, that's going to end up in this gigantic moment matrix. But if you focus on this two-body correlators, then what you end up is a block diagonal moment matrix. And in each of these blocks, with some repetitions, you will only have these short-range correlations. And basically, the size of these blocks, or the size of these largest blocks, defines memory use, because each of these blocks in the SDP solver goes through a Cholesky decomposition at some point as the solver works, and this is very memory hungry. So this has a quadratic scaling in terms of memory use for the size of this matrix. That's the main constraint in solving SDPs. This is true for interior point solvers, which is the vast majority of solvers out there.
In the absence of a chord, you mean the interaction between not nearest neighbors?
Okay, wait. So let's go back to that diagram. So what happens here is that initial, like if you ignore the red edges, then you know that's what we say, what would be say the interaction matrix between in a nearest neighbor isomodal. But you have to factor in, you have to add edges to this matrix to fulfill the mathematical conditions to ensure that the resulting hierarchy will converge to the original hierarchy. And the original hierarchy converges so that that ensures that the whole thing goes in the right direction. So you may have to make the graph chordal to ensure the theoretical condition of convergence. And what it means in practice is that like some of the terms are going to repeat across different blocks. So you will see the same monomial appearing in different blocks. So that creates these additional connections in this positive semi-definite constraint. And it's not just a theoretical condition, really, because if it's not chordal, then we see that the result just go completely off. Yep.
Yeah, just some basic questions about, so if someone's trying to do an optimization problem,
mm-hmm.
and suppose it's an NNP, then they can verify the solution. Does that mean they can verify that it's an optimum, that it's a global optimum in polynomial time? Or are many of these problems not an NP, they're NP hard or something?
Well, for an NP problem, you can always verify the solution from polynomial time.
Right. So, I mean, are you? So, then my question, so I'm trying to understand how your verification piece fits into like a story of usefulness. So, someone has a problem, they want to run it on a D wave quantum computer, they get an answer. How does your method fit into their?
So, if, their and story? Okay, and okay, let's then we can talk about like any kind of ansatz for finding the ground state of a many body problem. Okay, so that can be the Bose-Hubbard model, you name it. And all other ansatzes, so say this is the ground state, okay? Ground state energy. And whatever ansatz you use, it's going to end up with some, a good method will end up with decreasing upper bounds, the ground state energy. And on a good day, it will find the same. I mean, it will find a ground state. This is also true when you use the D-wave quantum envelope.
Are you saying this is not a problem in NP?
What I'm saying that all of these heuristic methods are in P.
Are in P.
I mean, they were developed to get some approximation of the ground state energy. And
I mean, aren't we interested in cases that are in NP because then the quantum computer is supposed to help us? My kind of paradigm. Is that not what you were assuming?
That's an open question, right? Like whether they can solve anything. What we are interested in is getting the correct solution fast in practical runtime.
On what
and,
part? Sorry, on a classical computer?
In either case. So the problem with these... Okay, so let's look at the Ising model. So we know that, you know, in general, it's NP hard to solve. But there are many, 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 many subclasses of this Ising model which are actually NP, right? And in fact, I find it terribly difficult to tell just by looking at the Ising model whether it's a hard case or whether it's an easy case. So what we try to do is identify cases which are provably hard. And there are some. And so in principle, polynomial time algorithms should break down. But even then, we find that very often the polynomial time algorithm, for instance, our chordal Benjamin-Brown finds the ground state energy. So I think the moral of the story is, and it's a very hand-wavy thing, is that NP hard looks at as the worst case scenario, but it's quite possible that many problems in that in fact, might be most problems in that problem class are actually in P.
So if I could just get you to say, what is the scenario where this method you've described helps in some way?
So in all of these, where you have some upper bound on the ground state energy, it gives you an increasing lower bound. So what you can do, which you could not do with any other method so far, is that say you get this solution here, which you don't know whether it's the ground state energy or higher than that, and you get the certificate here that we give, you can tell the delta. So you can get this difference between the two. So you can get a sense of how far you could possibly be from the ground state energy.
How far you could possibly be, but you might be actually quite a bit closer.
That's right. But then you increase the size of the relaxation, and then you get closer.
And do you have any guarantees about how much effort has to be put in terms of size, increasing the size to?
Well, that we only know that it converges in the asymptotic limit. And, you know, if I could tell you that, hey, you know, in polynomial number of steps, you always get a certificate, then that would be a solution to an NP-hard problem in polynomial time. So in general, it's not possible. But in most cases, what you're going to see that these two coincide, which means that your actual solution is the ground state energy.
Okay, which class of problems do you find that for?
Well, we studied the Ising model and a bunch of problems within the Ising model, which we thought were you know, in NP, like strictly NP, but then we found that it actually finds the ground state energy.
I see. So this is actually a method for showing that an instance of this problem is in P, in fact. Is that a way to understand this?
Yeah, that's a nice way to put it. Yeah. Yeah. I didn't think about it that way, but yeah.
Thank you.
More questions? Patrick.
Do you know if your RBM code for D-Wave is also online?
Our code for D-Wave will go online in about a month.
Okay.
And what's interesting about it is that RBMs are a lot harder to train on a quantum hardware than a fully connected Boltzmann machine. And it has something to do with the locality of the temperature. So when you looked at this graph from D-Wave, this one, it turns out that each and every one of these unit cells have a different temperature. And that completely screws up restricted Boltzmann machines.
Just an observation, and you know, if you have any comments, have you any insights on to how the geometry of the structure? I mean, this is clearly a you know square cell geometry, basically, may affect your ability to produce results.
Yes, it basically rules out all problems that I actually want to solve. Because what you have to do, it has this weird connectivity structure, right? And if you want to embed a complete graph, then you're restricted to a total of 50 spins, right? And that's just not interesting to solve. And that's one problem. And the other problem is that embedding a graph into this graph in itself an NP problem.
Yeah.
And so you use a heuristic algorithm to find an embedding. It very often fails. And even if it finds one, it might be very redundant. And it takes a long time. So for instance, embedding a non-trivial graph in this 2048 physical qubit can take hours, whereas running the annealer 1,000 times takes 50 milliseconds.
Sure.
So you end up with this massive classical overhead of approximating an NP-hard problem to solve another NP-hard problem or approximate another NP-hard problem on the chip. So it's stupid. So this is why D-Wave is not increasing the qubit numbers anymore so crazily. Because in the next generation of the chip, they increase the connectivity. Because that achieves two things. That achieves that this classical overhead is much less because it's easier to probabilistically embed the graph that you're interested in. You have a much richer family of problems that you can solve because of the increased connectivity. But this problem is going to exist in every single superconducting architecture simply because we are restricted to the 2D surface.
Sure.
So when you look at IBM, Rigetti, or Google, you know, they all have a connectivity problem. So as long as the connectivity problem is there, our methods can work.
Till we get some end dimension.
And if you get some trapped ion system that actually scales, then that's that.
Thank you.
Well, if there are no more questions, then thank you very much.